You might check and see if there's any handouts, Aaron. They'd be in the office. I don't know if there are any handouts or not. There should be, but I didn't check. We are continuing on now in the section that we're in. I remember I told you that we started a section, a four-part section last week with the with Christian emerging from Vanity Fair and linking up with Hopeful, and then the first person they run into is this man Byens, and his the profile study that we had is the first of three more developing issues that are kind of interlinked and connected. And so after the conversation ended last time, you remember that that Byens, well, could somebody tell me by way of a little review what kind of character Byens was? What did he turn out to be? Anybody remember? Particularly in a religious sense, remember the Vanity Fair had no use for religious characters. They were very hostile and very rejecting of them. Byens comes from another place where religion is considered part of upper crust, a high society. It's a place that it's not only accepted; it is what good people do. You know, they go to church, they mingle together in such places. And he turned out to be the kind of guy that there were a couple of analogies that described his use of religion, or his attention to religion, or his loyalty to his Christian faith. Can somebody tell me what those were? One was nautical terms?
Going one way, looking the other.
Well, no, that's what he was doing, but he would go with his religion in wind and tide. You remember when it was convenient and appropriate and proper, and of course profitable and beneficial. And then the other is that he would go with religion when she wore something. Her silver slippers. Don't you just love that analogy? I just love that analogy. There weren't any? Okay. And so, you know, he approached Christian and Hopeful to have audience with them. The weather is fair. The road is level. Let's pursue fellowship. And so he said he offered to do that. And what did Christian do? Did he take him under his wing? Did he say, "Well, I'll try to disciple this guy"? What did he do? Okay, he drew the line on those very points. You know, saying that it's not only when it's convenient, but when it's inconvenient, you have to be willing to take your stand for your faith, even in times when it is not popular, and when you must go around bound in irons, as well as when your religion wears silver slippers. And and of course, was Byens persuaded by that? No. And why not? Why wouldn't he be persuaded to be more courageous with his faith? Why would that be offensive to him?
He'd have to take a stand against. He would have to take a stand.
Okay, he'd have to take a stand, but why would he be against doing that? Well, right. You see, religion had its purpose. That was the point, or Byens. Religion had its purpose, and religion's purpose was to benefit me in this life. If I could use the church that I go to make right social connections, so that I might get a better job, or so that I might have better contacts in society, then sure, that's fine. If it would allow me to to do the things that I want to do, then sure, using religion is the point. And of course, if any tool that you use, you know, pick whatever hobby or whatever kind of trade you're in, if you pick up a tool, you pick up a particular tool for a particular purpose. You have wood that you want to cut, you pick up a saw, and you use that saw, and you use it in a way that cuts the wood. But if you want to hammer a nail, you don't use a saw, you pick up a hammer. And, you know, so he was seeing religion as just the tool, just the proper tool for what else is important. So he's communicating to you, of course, what priority religion has in his life. It is not the end all. That's for radical people, people who really don't have a life. Religion is not the reason you live. You live by you incorporate religion into your life for your betterment. And of course, the real purpose, the real focus of that, the real climax of that, or the inevitable result of that is that religion is not something that you cling to or you practice with an anticipation of eternal life. That it's just simply something that's for this life only. So when Christian draws his line, he is not accepting of that. He's polite and he steps away from Christian and doesn't have anything to do with him, and so he lingers behind for a little while, and Christian and Hopeful go on, and that's where we pick it up now. Now I saw in my dream that Christian and Hopeful forsook him and kept their distance before him, but one of them, looking back, saw three men following Mr. By-ends, and behold, as they came up with him, he made them a very low kungee. Anybody know what a kungee is? Now kungee, depending on how you spell it, with two E's, which is the way it's spelled in here, is actually a rice dish, a Japanese rice dish. He's not talking about making him a rice dish, or Chinese rice dish, rather. But if you spell it with only one E, at least as the dictionary says it, kanji is what? I don't know where the word, what word comes from. It didn't make any connection. It's a ceremonious bow. The interesting thing about it is that it's normally a bow of departure. So I wouldn't make too big a deal out of this. It's just... but he makes a ceremonious bow, an expression of polite greeting in this case. The picture broadens here to represent the considerable number of pilgrims who pursue the privileges of heaven while maintaining an indulgent life on earth. So this man fashionably bows and welcomes these three people, these three men that come up to him. And they also gave him a compliment, and the men's names were Mr. Hold the World, Mr. Money Love, and Mr. Save All, men that Mr. By-ends had formerly been acquainted with, for in their minority they were schoolfellows taught by one Mr. Gripe Man, a schoolmaster in Lovegain, which is a market town in the county of Coveting. Sounds English, doesn't it? Coveting. Kind of reminds you of Coventry. Coveting. In the north. This schoolmaster taught them the art of getting, capital G, getting, either by violence, cozenage, flattery, lying, or by putting on a guise of religion. And these four gentlemen had attained much of the art of their master so that they could each of them have kept such a school themselves. So this tells us a lot about the background of the conversation they're going to have and the rapport they're going to have. These are four very well-known buddies. They have been in school together. They've been taught by the same professor, and they are all of the same mind. But they have different characteristics. We're given their names already. Let's look at them one by one. The first one is Mr. Hold the World. What does that strike you? What kind of character would this be? Hold the World.
He can just put everything in the world. He grasps it. That's
okay.
There's no coming life. It's right here and now.
All right. Of course, one way we can analyze this is to study the opposite. What would be the opposite of hold the world? Give the world, right? Give the world. Serve serve with worldly things. Mr. Hold the World sees religion, as that complement attached to other notable and fine advances in the human race. So he's very similar in that way to Mr. Baez. He sees no problem with pursuing the things of the world, and in fact sees it as a very noble pursuit. What about Mr. Money Love? Anybody have a slightest idea what that is? Nobody wants to admit it, right? Because in a sense, we're all money love, aren't we?
Well, it's important. You have to have some.
You have to have some.
Some people think the more you have.
Thank you, Miss Hold the Money. No, just kidding. Money Love. Okay, what about Mr. Money Love?
He likes it too much, maybe.
Likes it too much, maybe. Okay.
Not sure.
All right, that's a good start. What else? What would this tell you? Can you ever have enough?
Oh, yeah, well, that's true. The more.
No, you can never have enough.
Yeah.
So,
more, I guess.
So of course that defines for you, what his motive is. And if that's his motive and that's his design and his character, how does he go about getting his money? What? Well, yeah, kind of like buy-ins. The yens justify the means. And what would be the role of religion in his life? Okay. All right. So there's we read from the law this morning, you cannot serve both God and mammon. And, of course, that's the very first verse, I'm convinced, that's the very first verse that a Christian is tempted to throw out of the Bible. To the very first verse, we are very tempted to say, this really doesn't apply to me. The rest of the Bible may apply to me, but this is the very first one that I think we're all tempted to say, well, I don't, I'm not so sure, Jesus. I think I can serve God and mammon. I don't think there's a real problem there. I'm able to, I've got lots of things here, and I can balance. I can do all kinds of things. It's the first place that we challenge the authority of Christ is in that verse, that when he says you cannot serve both God and mammon. You cannot have two masters. And we say, well, I'm not so sure. I think I can. And he says the reason you can't is that you will love the one and despise the other. If you love money, why would you despise Christ? Why would that have to be?
They have times when they actually conflict with each other.
Okay, because one of them has to be a priority in your life. It's kind of like marriage, isn't it? When you get married, you're not only choosing one person, what else are you doing? Well, more than that, you're forsaking everyone else. That's the thing. That's the half that lots of marriages that we see in the world today, and in Hollywood and everything else, is that's the last thing that they really do. Is they don't they choose the one for now, but they aren't forsaking everybody else. That's the world is still out there. We're going to date. We're going to play the field. We're going to have a great time. The problem is that you can only give devotion and love and priority to one thing, one person, that's a characteristic of who we are, and Christ is saying that to us. It's not debatable. It's whether we are going to embrace and submit to that or not. Oftentimes, that's like I said, that's the very place where we challenge the authority of Christ right off the bat. Is right there.
The fact that in many places in the world, the way that Christians are often persecuted is by the confiscation of property.
Uh-huh.
That the government, whoever the authority is, will come and say, apostatize, or will simply take everything from you.
Right.
And that is really where the nice test.
Sure. But in a case like that where you've got some committed Christians, I would suspect that just simply the removal of some material items would disorient and confuse and bring fear. So it's not just simply the taking away of money or things that we, because that's where our hearts are, but for the extra confusion and for the extra intimidation that is. Money love would have no problem with that because he sees no issue in compartmentalizing his trade and dealings apart from his religion. Save all. Now there's an interesting term. Who is save all? Besides good Christmas shoppers. Who would a save all? Who would save all be? Meaning what? Okay, whatever he gets, he keeps. There's some definite similarity in the characteristics. They have been trained by the same man, right? They've been trained all to think in the same way. They have different characteristics, different slants on it, but they're all kind of very similar kind of people. And we run into all of those very similar kind of people within and without the church as well, and sometimes in the mirror. And then it becomes a problem. Save all, I don't think there is a religious slant to this in John Bunyan's mind. One could say, well, is he saying this is some kind of Arminian doctrine, universal salvation kind of thing? It's not out of the question that could be such a person who has his eye on the world would also be one to say that I don't buy a religion that condemns people. That is, unless they're really, really, really bad, and I'll be the judge of that. But otherwise, then everybody is just fine in my book. I'm not going to burn bridges. After all, I might be able to have business with this person, so I don't want to condemn him, religiously. But save all also has a practical aspect to it. He would see no issue or problem carrying a religion with respectability and engaging in all of the pursuits of the world without restraint. In other words, it would stand a reason that the law of God would be thrown out in his mind. He would see no problem in engaging in a business pursuit or endeavor on the Lord's Day, or if it was a good legitimate kind of thing. If there was any other aspect that took him away from not just from the practice of church, but also the reputation of Christianity, he would be glad to do that under any guise that he would. There wouldn't be any religious structures or restrictions to his life. If this is a pursuit that I'm interested in, then my religion doesn't get in the way. It's what I want. It's what makes me happy. It's what's going to bring me peace. It's a legitimate thing to do. I'm going to go ahead and do it. And so he doesn't want a part of a religion or a faith that's going to say that there are rights and wrongs just hanging over your head, and that this is what you must do and this is what you must not do in any circumstance or condition. He's going to say, well, my religion has its place, and if it has its place, then it stays in its place, and it doesn't master me. So all of these guys have varying slants on the thing, but they're all very similar, and that is that their religion is their tool. It's just something to make life better, and something that I wish to employ to gain my pursuits in the world. And they have learned all of this from Mr. Gripe Man. Now that's an odd name for us under the circumstances. They're all schooled by a Mr. Gripe Man in love gain of coveting. Now, love gain of coveting, we get, that's... But where does he get Gripe Man? Why does he mention that? Why is the teacher Gripe Man? Because he likes to gripe. Yeah, what would he gripe about? What would he be teaching them by griping? First of all, do you think that if Gripe Man was, remember how he's just how these students are described toward the end? It says these four gentlemen had attained much of the art of their master, so that they could each of them have kept a school themselves. But notice they don't keep a school themselves. What do? They're out in the world getting and gaining and gaining and getting. Gripe Man is teaching. What do they say? What's the old adage? He who can do, you know, I'm married to one, so I know.
Watch yourself.
He who can, does. He who can't, teaches. And he who can't, teach, pastors, right? so here's Mr. Gripe Man, and he's teaching greed and avarice and priorities of the world to them. Maybe it's because he is very unsatisfied with life himself. And all he can do, the best thing he can do in the bitterness of his soul is to pass it on to somebody else who might be able to do better even than him. He is a master of clutching, and that is gaining by coercion. Somebody who gripes is never satisfied. You know, that characteristic is one where he's never at peace with himself, never has enough. And so any tool that he uses to intimidate, to gain, to steal, to lie, cheat, to endeavor for the purpose of gaining for himself is absolutely legitimate. And that's the very kind of thing that he teaches to his students. Well, when they had, as I said, thus saluted each other, Mr. Moneylove said to Mr. Byends, "Who are they upon the road before us? For Christian and Hopeful were yet within view." Byends says, "There are all they." Now, this is Mr. Byends. Remember, he's already talked to Christian and Hopeful. What kind of description is Byends going to give of Christian and Hopeful? This is going to be very interesting. What kind of opinion will he give of Christian and Hopeful just in their conversation? "They are a couple of far countrymen that after their mode are going on pilgrimage." After their mode. Now that's a fairly honest way to describe it. By the way, it kind of makes you wonder why these guys would say they are going on pilgrimage, wouldn't it? What kind of pilgrimage are they going on? You know, they would have to admit they're getting old and they, you know, even their lives are mortal, and sure, we're going to go to the celestial city after we're done with this life. But, you know, isn't it odd that he would find them on the way? He would find them in pilgrimage, so to speak. Anyway, he says, after their mode, they're going on pilgrimage. Moneylove says, "Alas, why did they not stay? That we might have their good company. For they and we and you, sir, I hope, are all going on pilgrimage." "We are so indeed, but the men before us are so rigid and love so much their own notions and do also so lightly esteem the opinions of others that let a man be never so godly, yet if he jumps not with them in all things, they thrust him quite out of their company." So what is his opinion of Christian and Byends?
Narrow-minded.
Narrow-minded. Arrogant. You know, the old adage, it's my way or the highway.
That's right.
And, you know, that's the kind of attitude that Christian and Hopeful have impressed upon Byends. Yes, it's either their way or no way. They definitely have their own opinions and they're sticking to it. Is that a fair description, or is that just bitterness and contempt coming out?
It's pretty fair.
Yeah, it is, isn't it?
That's right. Yeah.
Is there anything wrong with being described that way by somebody who doesn't comprehend it? You know, it's not how we want to be described, right? We don't want to be narrow-minded. We don't want to be considered rigid. We want to be considered with the positive of those kinds of attributes, focused, priorities in a different place, committed, you know, careful not to careful not to allow temptations to sneak into the world. But from the outside looking in, it looks like we're rejecting everybody and everything else. And of course, now every once in a while, you might get a twinge of conscience. Well, maybe I shouldn't be that way. Maybe I should be a little more laid back. Maybe I should go into the world easy. You know, maybe I don't need to offend anybody right off the bat. Have you ever wrestled with that in your own life when you're dealing with people that are outside the faith? You're going to a party or you're associating with those and you think, well, now I don't want to turn them off. And right away, even when you go into the door of such a situation like that, you know, the battle is yours. It's not theirs. The battle is yours. How much compromise is legitimate? How much is appropriate? How much must I bend to show I'm not rigid? How wide open should I allow my conversation and my vocabulary and the topics that I speak about get so I won't be judged as being narrow-minded? It's a losing venture, isn't it? It's always a losing venture to do that. We want to relate to people. We want to be friends with those who don't have the priorities and the focus that we do. But the battle is always ours. It's never theirs. We never put them on the spot. The battle is always in our conscience. You know, should I listen to that dirty joke? Should I tell a dirty joke so that they'll think I'm like them? And the battle is always within us. Should I do this? Should I say that? Should I hang around in their company this long? Should I be? The battle is always ours. And when that happens, our consciences are always on the line. And you know, what would the lesson that Christian and Hopeful give us here? You know, there are certain compassionate efforts that we have from time to time to see others attracted to us for holiness reasons. There are other times and other circumstances in our lives where we actually find we are buy-ins and hold the world and money love and save all because we have an ulterior motive. There is something we want. That's why we're there. We want something. And so we allow ourselves to venture into those kinds of places or those kinds of circumstances. We find we're sacrificing, we're compromising our priorities and our focus so that we can get what we want. We find ourselves, whoa, we're starting to use Christianity as a tool. Because we've got something in mind. And so we can slip into this very easily without even thinking about it. But don't forget, the battle is always in our conscience. And we are always the losers when we do that. We're always the losers. Because we're always giving in. We're always having to mold in, being pressed into the world. We're always having to yield in order to get what we want. Or be accepted. Or whatever it is. Dan, did you have your hand up? If we have the pleasure and the opportunity to explain that, we definitely should. What if we don't? What if we don't have this opportunity to sit down and talk? What if this person is just not interested in that much dialogue? It really does come down to what Christian said. You know, you can be in fellowship with us, but we cannot bend on the mission that our God has put us on. Perhaps to do it humbly, you might even say that for literary purposes, you know, Bunyan did not allow Christian to have a very humble approach to that. But nonetheless, he said, this is where the line is drawn. I choose not to compromise in order to be accepted by you, because I will not let myself use my faith, use my religion as a tool just to get something for myself later. But surely if we have the opportunity, if we have the benefit, we should be very eager to communicate the grace of the gospel, because that's the thing that gives us our focus. That's the thing that gives us our energy. It's not that we're, you know, if it was works righteousness, then we would just be like all of these guys. We would just have a spiritual focus. We're gaining eternal life. We don't have to worry about that. We have eternal life. And we're focusing a commitment and a zeal to that which God has given us that is absolutely precious. And when we compromise and we lose the battle with our consciences and we surrender those things, we're really setting that aside and saying that is not as important as getting this or being liked by that person or whatever. Yeah, well, by compromise, Irene, you're meaning we don't need to beat them over the head. We don't need to be talking about our religion all the time. Or something like that, which is, like I said, more stressing the humility of our character. And I think that would probably, I'd use that more than saying compromise. But yeah, there's a certain essence in which our love for someone else, our calling to love other people, doesn't mean that we have to march into every situation and draw the line and say, you're either with me or against me. But the battle for our consciences is where we are tempted, without saying anything to anybody, we're tempted to compromise who we are in order to be liked, in order to gain something for ourselves. So I think there are those two aspects. Certainly living the Christian life with humility is a practice we all need to exercise. And sometimes humility requires us to keep our mouths shut. But I wouldn't regard that as a compromise necessarily. We would agree on that.
Yes.
Yeah. Thank you, Doctor. Okay. So Baez is describing them and saying that they're rigid and that it's either their way or the highway, and Mr. Saval says, that's bad, but we read of some that are righteous overmuch, and such men's rigidness prevails with them to judge and condemn all but themselves. See, so he's picked up on perhaps a little bit about what's been said. You know, there's the same kind of violation, by the way, was had in Vanity Fair. You know, just the fact that they were there communicated a judgmentalism to other people. They said, they're judging us. They didn't say a word, you know. What's the old story about Billy Graham playing golf? You ever hear that? Billy Graham was invited to play golf with three other guys one time, and one of the guys came in and he was furious, threw his clubs down, had a rotten day, I guess, you know, and said, I hate being preached to all the time. And Billy Graham hadn't said a word. Hadn't said a word. But, you know, just the air of having him in the group was enough to make him feel condemned and judged and put down. And
coming from him.
Yes, yes. And Vanity, the people in Vanity Fair rose up with that very same kind of thing. Saval here is saying the same, you know, he's saying, oh, yeah, they're... But he's returning the favor. He's not intimidated. He's not angry to the point of violence. He's judging back. He's saying, yes, they're righteous over much. They take things to an extreme. They take their religion to an extreme, and they are to be pitied. Why they, Bayen says, after their headstrong manner, conclude that it is their duty to rush on their journey all weathers, and I am for waiting for wind and tide. They are hazarding all for God at a clap. And I am for taking all advantages to secure my life and estate. They are for holding their notions through all other men, though all other men be against them. But I am for religion in what and so far as the times and my safety will bear it. They are all for religion when in rags and contempt, but I am for him when he walks in his golden slippers. Now it's golden slippers. In sunshine and with applause. It's getting worse. You know, he's got to have gold slippers, sunshine, applause. But you know, so he's accurate. He's describing it well. He's being very honest, but he's also defending it. You know, he's saying, you know, this surely my religion has its place. It has its purpose. I'm you know, he's revealing to us what the goal that he has in life, and he's very honest about it, saying it certainly isn't just to be Christian. It is to use my faith in whatever serves me and serves my purposes. Mr. Hold the World says, "Aye, and hold you there still, good Mr. Byens." Did you catch that? These are his friends, grown up since childhood. You know, intimate buddies. What do they call him? Remember what he said? That, oh, that's an unfortunate nickname that some have impugned upon me. Here's his good friends, and they call him the same thing, Mr. Byens. This is a noble name in their idea. You know, this is who you are. This is great. He says, "Good Mr. Byens, for my part, I can count him but a fool, and that having the liberty to keep what he has shall be so unwise as to lose it. Let us be as wise as serpents." What's he leaving out there, of course? You know, innocent as doves, yeah. The innocent part, the humility, the graciousness. You know, let us be wise as serpents. Let's use what we have so that we don't lose it. Let's gain from our faith. Let's profit. It's best to make hay when the sun shines. You see how that, now he hits us with lots of epithets here. It's best to make hay when the sun shines. You see how the bee lieth still all winter and bestirs her only when she can have profit with pleasure. God sends sometimes rain and sometimes sunshine. If there be such fools to go through the first, yet let us be content to take fair weather along with us. For my part, I like that religion best that will stand with the security of God's good blessings unto us. For who can imagine that is ruled by his reason, since God has bestowed upon us the good things of this life, but that he would have us keep them for his sake? Abraham and Solomon grew rich in religion, and Job says that a good man shall lay up gold as dust, but he must not be such as the men before us, if they be as you have described them. Lots of wisdom there, right? What's wrong with it? He seems well read, cites men in Scripture that grew rich. What's wrong with that? Didn't God bless Abraham? No, no, no. Right, right. He's saying, his whole perspective is very worldly and very common, isn't it? You know, God helps those who what? Oh, you know it very well. And where is that found? Which chapter? What verse?
That's found in the world.
Yes. Yes, everybody knows that verse. Okay, all right. What Sunday school did you guys grow up in?
The wrong one.
Yes, right, okay. Right? Spoken like a well-intentioned mother. Right, right. Bel Air needs doctors.
Exactly. It neglects God's call on your life. And the fact that I'd be the first to tell anybody that God's call on your life doesn't always make sense from the world's perspective.
Mm-hmm. Right.
It's always tie up in a neat little box for the bell.
Very good. It is a worldly perspective, and it is a satisfactory justification. All of that that's what it is. Of course, it's a justification for greed and selfishness, with a religious tone and dressing. This is religion dressed up in her golden slippers right here. and this is exactly what they have been taught and what they embrace. I think that we are all agreed in this manner, and therefore there needs no more words about it. No more than needs no more words about it. There needs no more words about this matter, Mr. Moneylove says. For he that believes neither Scripture nor reason, and you see we have both on our side, neither knows his own liberty nor seeks his own safety. My brethren, we are, as you see, going on pilgrimage, and for our better diversion from things that are bad, give me leave to propound unto you this question. Suppose a man, a minister, why pick on a minister? Or a tradesman, or what have you, should have an advantage lie before him to get the good blessings of this life, yet so as that he can by no means come by them, except in appearance at least, he becomes extraordinarily zealous in some points of religion that he meddled not with before. May he not use this means to attain his end, and yet be a right, honest man? Now this this is good stuff, because this is very close to home. You know, it could be I could wax eloquent about this. You know, when the question. All right, I'll open the hood here and let you guys in on a little little bit of discussion. One thing that the ministers talk about or wonder about, pray about, is when is it proper to take another call? Is it simply a spirit-led thing? Or am I ever to say, I'd like to move closer to my family someday? Or I'd like to go to some place where I can get a little more esteem. A little more praise, a little more money. When is it appropriate? And what circumstances would it make appropriate? You know, you kick that back and forth. So this is very close here. He's talking about things which don't strike, which aren't just merely striking liberal churches and liberal ministers and money-grubbing ministers and stuff. But now we're talking about honest, sincere men who have personal lives as well. And so this is a very interesting situation. Mr. Moneylove says, I see the bottom of your question, and with these gentlemen's good leave, I will endeavor to shape you an answer. And first to speak to your question as it concerns a minister himself. Suppose a minister, a worthy man, possessed but a very small benefice, a small charge, in other words. You remember, this is the state church. Unlike Presbyterian churches, these are churches where men are assigned to particular flocks for a particular reason at a particular rate of pay. And in order in a state-run church to move on or to move up, they schmooze, they politic, they must, it's who you know kind of thing. And so that's the background to this. Suppose a minister, a worthy man, possessed but a very small benefice, a very small charge, and has in his eye a greater, more fat and plump by far. He has also now an opportunity of getting it, yet so as by being more studious, by preaching more frequently and zealously, because the temper of the people requires it, by altering of some of his principles. So whatever that could be. Maybe he's a six-day creationist, but his denomination is very wide in this, and so he's going to say, "Well, creation doesn't matter." Or maybe he's dyed-in-the-wool post-mill, but all of the better churches are pre-mill. So he says, "Well, maybe I'll be pre-mill," changes principles to fit the situation that would provide him the most opportunity to come. And of course he's going to preach on that, and he's going to make himself known about those changes. For my part, I see no reason but a man may do this, provided he has a call, and a great deal besides, and yet be an honest man. For why? Well, number one, his desire of a greater benefice is lawful. Nothing wrong with wanting a little more money, a little more position, a little more popularity. And this cannot be contradicted, since 'tis set before him by providence, so then he may get it if he can. In other words, if God opens the door, go through it, making no question for conscience' sake. Number two, Besides, his desire after this benefice makes him more studious. He's going to have to study. Maybe he gets a higher degree. Maybe he gets a little more attention for his day. And if he studies more, then the church will benefit from that. That's what he's saying. He makes him more studious, a more zealous preacher, and whatever. And so that makes him a better man. Yes, makes him better to improve his parts, which is according to the mind of God. Number three, now as for his complying with the temper of his people by dissenting to serve them, some of his principles, in other words, changing his principles to suit the wind and tide, this argues, number one, that he is of a self-denying temper. Isn't that great? I'm going to remember that. I can compromise because I'm denying myself. That's great. I like that. Number two, of a sweet and winning deportment. Yes, that means that I'm not going to turn anybody off. I'm not going to offend anybody by having a position on any of those things. Number three, and so more fit for ministerial function. You see, it takes a sleazy, greasy guy to be a good minister, a good good pastor. See, that's where you blew it. Number four, I conclude that a minister that changes a small for a great should not, for so doing, be judged as covetous, but rather, since he is improved in his parts and industry hereby, in other words, he gets better by chasing the brass ring, hereby be counted as one that pursues his call, an opportunity put into his hand to do good. And now to the second part of the question, which concerns the tradesman. Ah, now the spotlight's on you guys. Suppose such a one to have but a poor employ in the world. Relative term, isn't it? Poor employ. Never have enough. My job is never big enough, never good enough. Poor employ in the world. But by becoming religious, by joining the right church, becoming an elder in a prestigious church, he may mend his market, perhaps get a rich. For my part, I see no reason but that this may be lawfully done. For why? Number one, to become religious is a virtue. Religion is a virtue. By what means soever a man becomes so. In other words, it doesn't matter how you do it. Religion is a virtue. Number two, nor is it unlawful to get a rich wife. See, that's where most of you blew it. Or more custom to my shop. Number three, besides, the man that gets these by becoming religious gets that which is good of them that are good by becoming good himself. So then here, he's not becoming a crook, he's not becoming a thief, he's becoming a better person. He's becoming a pillar in society. He's moving up, he's gaining all of these things. These are good things. So here is a good wife, good customers, good gain, and all of these by becoming religious, which is good. Therefore, to become religious, to get all of these, is a good and profitable design. This answer thus made by Mr. Moneylove to Mr. Byan's question was highly applauded by them all, wherefore they concluded upon the whole that it was most wholesome and advantageous. Now, we won't stop to dissect this because we're running out of time, so I want to move right on. And because, as they thought, no man was able to contradict it, and because Christian and Hopeful were yet within the call, they jointly agreed to assault them with the question as soon as they overtook them, and the rather because they had opposed Mr. Byans before. So they called after them, and they stopped and stood still till they came up to them. But they concluded as they went that not Mr. Byans, but old Mr. Holdtheworld should propound the question to them. So they're going to ask these same questions to Christian and Hopeful, but Byans isn't going to do it because they've already kind of, had a clash with Mr. Byans. So Mr. Holdtheworld is going to ask them the question to see if they would agree, because in their minds their logic is impeccable. This is a closed box. There isn't any other way to look at this. They surely will agree with us in this. And to have fun with them, they're going to ask Christian and Hopeful these very questions. And as they suppose, they answered him would be without the reminder of the heat that had kindled between Mr. Byans, and they'll get past that. So they come up to each other, and after a short salutation, Mr. Holdtheworld propounded the question to Christian and his fellow, and bid them to answer it if they could. Then Christian even said, said this, "Even a babe in religion may answer 10,000 such questions." You guys babes yet? Could you answer these questions? "For if it be unlawful to follow Christ for loaves, as it is in John 6, how much more abominable is it to make of him and religion a stalking horse to get and enjoy the world?" A stalking horse. In other words, a horse you ride, a tool. Something that you get other things by. "Nor do we find any other than heathens, hypocrites, devils, and witches that are of this opinion." Number one, heathens. "For when Hamor and Shechem had a mind to the daughters and the cattle of Jacob, and saw that there was no ways for them to come at them but by being circumcised, joining the church. They said to their companions, 'If every male of us be circumcised as they are circumcised, shall not their cattle, their substance, and every beast of theirs be ours?' Their daughters and their cattle were that which they sought to obtain, and their religion the stalking horse that made use of to come at them." You can read the whole story in Genesis 34. "Two, the hypocritical Pharisees were also of this religion. Long prayers were their pretense, but to get widows' houses was their intent, and greater damnation was from God their judgment. Number three, Judas the devil was also of this religion. He was religious for the bag. That he, in other words, Judas, you know, was the one who carried the money for the group in the bag. He was religious for the bag, that he might be possessed of what was therein. But he was lost, cast away, and the very son of perdition. Number four, Simon the witch was of this religion too, for he would," this is the from Acts 8. Simon, you remember, wanted to buy the Holy Spirit. And that's why he's referring to him as a witch, because he was dealing in spiritual things for his own profit. "Simon the witch was of this religion too, for he would have had the Holy Ghost, that he might have got money therewith, and his sentence from Peter's mouth was according. May you and your money die and perish together," he said. Number five, neither will it out of my mind, but that man that takes religion for the world will throw away religion for the world." There it is. You know, there he's describing very carefully how the tool is discarded when its usefulness is over. And there, I think that line is the one that I want you to remember. You know, in regards to your own life, in regards to your own priority, in regards to your own choosing, you know, the only way you're going to determine whether you're using religion as a tool or not is whether or not you can ever imagine a time when you would discard it, if it ever got in your way. "For so surely as Judas designed the world in becoming religious, so surely did he also sell religion and his master for the same. To answer the question, therefore, affirmatively, as I perceive you have done, and to accept as authentic such answer is but heathenish, hypocritical, and devilish. And your reward will be according to your works." Then they stood staring one upon another. But had not wherewith to answer Christian. Hopeful also approved of the soundness of Christian's answer, so there was a great silence among them. Mr. Byans and his company also staggered and kept behind, that Christian and Hopeful might outgo them. Then said Christian to his fellow, "If these men cannot stand before the sentence of men, what will they do with the sentence of God? And if they are mute when dealt with by vessels of clay, what will they do when they shall be rebuked by the flames of a devouring fire?" There is a lot more just simply to say by way of this evaluation, but I think you get the point. And it strikes us, you know, this is one of the golden places in Pilgrim's Progress where the character where, you know, remember I said, told you at the very beginning that some of these characters are going to be outside and some of them are going to be inside? Very often, my friends, these are the characters that are inside us. It's not the ones that are, you know, we look across the table from somebody or we look over here and say, well, he is an absolute jerk. He uses religion for his own benefits and for his own profit. But there are times when we are the ones who wrestle with this ourselves. And we are the ones who have profit and design in this world and will use our religion in some way. Maybe we'll put it down on a resume because it looks good. Or because we'll leave it out because that looks better. Or we'll make contacts with somebody in the church because they can help us get something in an illicit way, a corrupt way of thinking, or a dishonest way, or something else. And we have to be very careful, because in those times, we would not be able to stand up under the judgment of men. And if we can't even stand up under the judgment of men, we will not stand before the judgment of God. So be careful about what your true ends in life are. Let's pray. Mm-hmm. Father in heaven, thank you very much again.